We do the news and five things the Points and Miles community dislikes more than they should on today's Milenomics Squared podcast.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sam Simon.
And I'm Robert Dwyer.
And this is the Milenomics Squared podcast, no annual fee edition.
If you're not subscribed to the full Milenomics Squared podcast, you're missing out on a deeper dive into topics like the following. Sam, you want to take news item number one?
Absolutely, yeah. First item here on the news is a rumor that the Citi Double Cash Card might earn thank you points. One of the things that we don't know is how this is going to work. Is it going to be a straight conversion, 2% to two thank you points? Is there going to be some other kind of sliding scale, 1.5 or maybe 1? And Robert, you brought up a good point on the paid show. This could also mean that this card will be capped at some kind of yearly maximum. It could be the best situation here, 2 for 2, but it could be something else. And so we'll have to just keep an eye on it. We'll definitely keep updating on that. Robert, you want to take this next one?
Yes, news item number two. Continuing with the thread on Citi here, Citibank has started to institute a 48-month waiting period on their co-branded American Airlines card. That is no bueno. That is getting to be a very long waiting period between sign-up bonuses on the AA cards. I know Barclays also issues AA cards, and you've got personal and business variants, but I don't like this trend. That's getting to be a really long time between two sign-up bonuses. So we talk a lot in the paid show about ways to skirt these restrictions, and I think a lot of people are comfortable with that for now, but you know, when those opportunities stop, what are you going to do? You're going to have a very long period of time between when you can get a lot of American Airlines miles, and without any one-to-one transfer, they become some of the harder airline miles to earn out there. Good for flights to Asia and other partners, so it's a good currency to have, but they're really becoming harder to get. So keep an eye on that. If you can find a link that's 24 months and you're outside of that, it might be time to go for one, but I think the trend is get used to AA miles being harder than ever to earn.
Oh yeah, bad news. Right on the heels of that here, we've got a heightened offer on a Bank of America Alaska Airlines personal card, and the offer is now up to 40,000 miles plus a $100 statement credit plus that companion fare that everybody loves to talk about. We have a link here in the show notes, and unfortunately, just like Citi has made things tougher, Bank of America's done the same in the last year. You now can't get this card if you've had or closed the card in the preceding 24 months. So, if you haven't had one, this is as good an offer as I've ever seen. Go ahead and consider it. Robert, you want to close us out here?
All right. Stop and Shop and Giant, Northeast Mid-Atlantic grocery chain, has 3x fuel rewards on Visa gift cards from 7/12 to 7/18. So check that out as a way to reduce the costs of your spend at grocery stores.
All right. So you guys have all the luck over there, too. It's just never ending with Stop and Shop and Giant.
It is a great chain.
Anyways, all right. So we got to get to this topic here, Robert. Hot on all of our other lists that we've been doing on this free show is one that you and I have talked about doing for quite some time here now. Five things that the Points and Miles community dislikes more than they should. And so what we're saying here is these are things that I think are universally disliked on some level. But we're saying, hey, look, something here is good. We're going to kind of turn this on its head and discuss why these things that everyone will agree at first blush is they're just terrible. Why they're not terrible, or why they're not as terrible maybe as you think they are. You think that's a pretty good overview there?
Very well phrased. Yep. Very well phrased. I like it a lot. You absolutely nailed it. You want to take item number one?
Item number one. The very first thing that we think everyone listening to this podcast will say, oh yes, that's the worst, are paying fuel surcharges on award flights. I know what you're thinking right there. You're listening to this show and you're going, oh yeah, that's the worst, right? And Robert, it's pretty bad, right? If you were given two opportunities, one, an award flight with no fuel surcharges, and the second, an award flight for the same number of miles with fuel surcharges, which would you pick?
Yeah, obviously take go for the one without fuel surcharges, but whatever, you see these flights out there, 70,000 miles plus $5.60 and some mandatory fee, and you think, oh, travel really is free, I can afford this flight for $5.60. But there are a ton of flights out there that are really great to lock in far ahead of time and have confidence that you're going to be traveling on a great international carrier or something like that, and sometimes they involve fuel surcharges. And there's nothing wrong with taking that flight if the total cost to you is something that you can wrap your head around.
I agree. You know, the choice, if there is a choice, obviously, the choice of not paying the fuel surcharge would be preferred, but that's just way too simple of an answer in a game that's as complex as the one that we are playing. And so if you are choosing between sitting on the couch and not going on vacation, or maybe flying coach in the back of the plane and paying fuel surcharges, I think that's the discussion that really that we're trying to have today, is to open up your mind to the idea that fuel surcharges maybe are a necessary evil sometimes. I like to think of them in a different way. Think of them as, what would you fly if you didn't take that flight with fuel surcharges? If you would be on an economy ticket for, let's say, roughly the same cost as a fuel surcharge, would you upgrade your fare for the miles that you pay for that ticket? So if a flight is 75,000 miles and $300 in fuel surcharges, would you, if you could buy that one way for $350 in economy, would you upgrade for 75,000 miles on the flight? And I would. I think that's a great use of miles. People write all the time about, oh, upgrade with miles. But then people also write, don't pay fuel surcharges. So I don't get it. It seems like a disconnect. I really want people to consider the flights that they want to take. We talk about that all the time here, right, Robert?
Yeah. And another thing we talk about all the time is paying fuel surcharges to open up award availability. We talked on the paid show a week or two ago about some award bookings we were either doing or thinking about doing. And a lot of cases we saw flights to Europe where you could see, you know, as many as five or even more people in the same premium cabin. And all you had to do was pay some fuel surcharges, and you would be able to lock up that perfect itinerary on the first Saturday of your spring break vacation. And all you had to do was pay some fuel surcharges. Now, yeah, you're going to pay miles and fuel surcharges, and it certainly isn't going to be free. But in a lot of cases, you're paying fewer miles than you would with the equivalent program in a U.S. carrier.
And with all of the,
with all the transfer bonuses we've been seeing to British Airways, to Air France Flying Blue, I mean, the list seems endless lately. You can really knock that down to being not that many miles. Yeah, maybe more cash than you wanted to lay out, but I think it's a case where you can get the vacation that you want to take by laying out some cash. So another thing I'll say is look at the totality of the itinerary and the total cost of it. Really, you know, like you say, back the price, the cash price out from the combination of the miles plus the fuel surcharges and the connecting flights and everything that you need to make the complete vacation. Do the math and say, does it make sense to pay fuel surcharges? And don't feel bad if you're paying $200-$300 in fuel surcharges if it gives you a really nice itinerary.
Yeah, especially the time aspect of it. I'm not sitting around an airport for 8, 10, 12 hours to connect, or I'm not rechecking my bags. The thing I hate the most, Robert, is flying internationally into the United States and having to clear customs and then get on another flight. That is the worst, isn't it? Yeah. And so,
torture.
Yeah, I would gladly pay to not have to do that because I really want to just get home. So I think we covered that one pretty well. You want to take this second one here?
Yes. Item number two is paying credit card annual fees. And you might think at first blush that, this affiliate blogger just wants me to sign up for this credit card because it has a high annual fee and he gets a big commission or something like that. But I really think it is true that some of the biggest rewards that you can get in this game come from signing up for credit cards with high annual fees. I mean, I talk to a lot of people and they say, hey, what's the best credit card? And I say, well, you know, get a bunch of credit cards is the thing to do. There's not one best credit card. But if I tell them about a credit card that has a $450 annual fee, the conversation stops. It might even stop when I talk about a credit card with a $99 annual fee. And people are just absolutely they have a chronic phobia against paying annual fees on credit cards. And I think it comes from a fear of being bamboozled by the complexity of a reward scheme that doesn't pay out what it's supposed to. The miles are going to be a pain in the neck to use, and it's not going to work out for them. So to absolve themselves of doing the hard work of vetting the quality of the overall deal, they just say, boop, nope, not paying an annual fee. I'm not getting any credit card with an annual fee. But if you do that, you really are limiting how well this game can work for you. So you have to be smart about it, and you really have to work to reduce those annual fees. A lot of times we talk about the benefits associated with a card being enough to overcome the annual fee. And I think a lot of times when people hear that, they think, oh yeah, well, you had some lounge access, so you think that's really reduced the annual fee? No, you're paying a bunch of money for that lounge access. But we talk a lot in the paid show about ways to truly eradicate the annual fee by making use of other benefits that come with cards. So if you're adept at playing the game, you can do very well with credit cards with annual fees, even credit cards with high annual fees, but it does take a lot of work. So travel is definitely not free, but I think by avoiding credit cards that have annual fees, that's just something that a lot of people in this game dislike more than they should. What do you think, Sam?
We started the show out with two banks that have gone from 0 month restrictions to 24 month restrictions, and in one case, 48 month restrictions. So that's not a positive, and that's the same restriction now that Chase has on their higher end cards, in addition to a cap of 5 cards in 24 months on all cards from all issuers. So holding a card has become the norm now. And so if you're going to get these cards for the giant signup bonuses that everyone agrees are great and useful, you then owe it to yourself to come up with a solution to keep the card for all of the other benefits that we can outline with as little out of pocket as possible. Yes, it's work. Yes, it means staying on top of your game. But hey, you get to listen to us along the way when you do that. So I think that the knee-jerk reaction, no, there's an annual fee, it's no good, really is something that's dangerous. It puts you at a disadvantage because you will quickly be locked out of all of the best cards that have ongoing benefits beyond just the sign-up bonus. All right, moving on to this third one. I think this is going to be the toughest one to discuss because the third topic we're covering here in the five things that the Points and Miles community dislikes more than they should is buying miles, especially from friends in the community. So we talked about outright buying miles, about 10 shows back, here on the free show as well, and that it's possible that there is a case where buying miles makes sense. Clearly not as much as you will read out there about sales on buying miles. So I want to preface all of the following discussion with this. You really should only buy miles if you're in a situation where you know you can use them in the short term and you have a very specific use case for them where you can get more than you're paying for them. Would you agree there, Robert?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Now, that said, this goes back to the first point we made. What are your options? If you're stuck and you have no options and your choice is either, buy an economy fare or stay at home, or you've got 90% of the miles to go on a trip and you really just need that last 10%, it really is a situation where buying miles could save the trip, could make the trip still possible. And so that's not really getting to the second part of this conversation, though, especially from friends in the community. Do you want to talk more about that, Robert?
Yeah, it gets a little tricky, I think, buying from friends of the community. I myself have a little bit of a tough time going there, but it's really a way to get to deeper discounts than what you can get by buying them from airlines and even when they're on sale, right? So a lot of people are just flush with miles that they haven't found a way to use. They just keep endlessly signing up for credit cards and like, oh, wait, all of a sudden I have 600,000 American Airlines miles. What am I going to do with these things? And they'd be happy to part with them for 1.25, 1.5 cents a piece, some number that you can agree on. And I think that's a really good way to do it if, again, you've got that award availability right in front of you and you know what you're going to do with. Now, buying miles from somebody else is against the terms and conditions of, I think, every program out there. So it's a little bit of a dicey space to navigate, but there's nothing that says you can't just buy a ticket for a family member or a friend. So there are ways to come to terms and make a deal work like that for you if you have a lot of friends in the community with a lot of points and miles. I think the net of it, though, is, again, going back to just taking the vacations that you want to take. If you're newer to the game and you see this great award redemption out there and you haven't had time to sign up for the credit cards to get the points and miles, you know, you look at it as just sometimes a tremendous discount versus paying cash for those tickets. So I think no matter how you slice it, buying miles is something that you should consider, especially if you're mile poor and you're in a good position cash-wise.
Ah, I'm glad you brought up cash because that brings us to our next topic, Robert. You want to take this one?
Yes. Number 4, paying cash for lodging. Boy, you know, what I see a lot in this game is a very kind of regimented approach to lodging. And it's along the lines of, I've got an obscene number of Marriott points. Where should I go? Or what are the best uses of Hilton free weekend night certificates? And I think that's a bad way to go about the game, to be blunt. I think you should, you know, start off with where do you want to go? What do you want to do? What kind of lodging do you want? Do you want a hotel room? Do you want a vacation rental? Do you want a timeshare? Do you want an Airbnb? And then work on paying for that, right? So some of those options are more a situation where you're paying cash, right? You know, it's very hard to pay for a vacation rental or timeshare sometimes with points and miles. But there are ways to do it, and they're not necessarily the points and miles that you would think of, you know, like a Hilton, a Hyatt, or a Marriott point. Sometimes they're bank points, and there are great ways to do that. So at some point, though, you just have to pay cash for it because the chain isn't associated with any loyalty program. They're not associated with any online travel agency, so you can't use bank points, and you can't even book it through hotels.com or anything. So if the place that you want to go, that you've always wanted to go, is a place that you can only pay cash for, I say go for it, right? Work on establishing enough cash from your points, miles, and cash back endeavors to pay for that place. Because at the end of the day, you don't want to say, you know, we traveled wherever there were loyalty hotels and we didn't go anywhere else because that was not free. Because, you know, it's not free to go to loyalty hotels because you end up having to make sacrifices and not earn rewards in other places to accrue those miles. But you really want to take the vacation you want to take. Go out there and stay. And sometimes you have to pay cash for it. So that's my number four. What do you think about that? You ever pay cash for lodging, or you try to always pay for
all the time?
Miles?
Yeah, I'm very anti. I think there's a long ago post on the blog that said Milenomics hates hotel points. And I wouldn't say I hate them anymore. Again, the game has softened a little bit or changed a little bit. But at the same time, cash is accepted everywhere. It's universally accepted. And so if you want to go somewhere and there is no Hyatt there and all you have are Hyatt points, your Hyatt points are not worth anything in that situation. And so there's that aspect to it. The other aspect that I want to bring up, and you mentioned it earlier in the show, it's something that I recommend you do on every booking you ever do, on every trip you ever take. Calculate it back out to the dollar. So if you're looking at a Hyatt that's 30,000 points, this happens all the time. People will say, I would never pay $300 for a hotel room, but I have no problem paying 30,000 Hyatt points for a hotel room transferred from Ultimate Rewards. Now, those same 30,000 points can book a hotel in the Ultimate Rewards portal worth $450 a night. So you are, in effect, every time you transfer 30,000 Hyatt points and book one night at a Category 7 Hyatt, every time you do that, you are in effect foregoing the ability to book a $450 a night hotel in the Chase Ultimate Reward portal. Now, there are some things that you have to consider there. You maybe don't get your loyalty benefits. You maybe don't get your potential upgrades and things like that. But you can buy a whole lot of hotel room for $450 a night. And in some parts of the world, you can buy a whole hotel for $450 a night, practically. So I think it's important to sit there and rationally consider, what am I paying in cash for this booking with points and miles? And say, you know, I could, especially hotels that have seasonal variability in their pricing in dollars. You had that great post about the five or six best and worst Hyatt hotels with seasonal pricing.
Yeah.
Because they don't change the price in points when the price in the hotel room goes up and down. And so that can cut both ways. You know, on 4th of July weekend, which we just passed, a booking in points can save you $600-$800 at a hotel that might be $129 other parts of the year. So it really pays to do the math. And that's what I want to say. There's no universal catch-all solution with hotels. And I think that paying cash is underrated because it's not as maybe as sexy as the quick sign up for a credit card. You can get all these points and get all these free nights. But really, where do you want to stay? Where do you want to go? And then how are you going to pay for that in the best way possible? That's what I recommend.
You absolutely nailed it. And I would just say the same exact things. That's just so perfect. I mean, I really think that there's got to be a number out there for how much more on average an equivalent chain hotel costs than a non not
non-branded or
whatever you call it. Yeah, just a small chain or whatever. Like what is a you know, say me and you open a residential business traveler hotel. What does it cost for that to be just not flagged at all versus a Courtyard by Marriott? I mean, it's got to be 20-30%, and you see that reflected in the prices, and it all works because every all of corporate America stays in the dumb Courtyard by Marriott. But and if we were opening a hotel, we'd want it to be a Courtyard by Marriott because it's a total cash stream. And if we're out there staying at a hotel and we're not beholden to the corporate overloads that are making us stay at these dumb, you know, hotel chains, then we should be more smart about things and go stay at the Court. It's not the dumb you know, whatever, the Ritz-Carlton or whatever. Every time I go look at a hotel in the Chase Ultimate Rewards portal, it tells you right there how many points it is with 1.5 cents a piece of uplift. It doesn't include tax, so it's not completely accurate, but I'm like, well, this is just a category 5 or 6 Hyatt. This is a great deal. And I can go stay at the Rosewood Hong Kong or the Four Seasons Hong Kong, and it's only like that famous category 7.5. It's only 35,000 points, so you can have whatever you want now. I really do think that that's the second thing you were talking about, that the game has changed. The game has changed in that the bank points with 1.5 cents a piece of uplift in the Chase portal that isn't price inflated. In a lot of cases, I'm seeing it 10% cheaper than Booking Direct. It's something that didn't exist 5 years ago. There wasn't 1.5 cents a piece of uplift anywhere. That Chase portal is really good for hotels.
I agree. And you know, there's a toggle that says free breakfast. So if you want free breakfast, you can get it. You don't have to have top tier loyalty, right? I mean, it's some hotels offer it to everyone.
There's also a toggle that says vacation rentals.
Oh, a sick burn. I'm leaving this in, Robert. I am leaving this in. Chase, you hear us now. Fix the vacation rentals tab.
We should have a moment of that in every podcast. Chase, fix the vacation rentals.
We should, right?
I keep going back and checking.
I think this last one we should have started with because it's going to get you more points and miles than all of the rest of these are going to use your points and miles. This one's going to get you more points and miles. And that is the thought that this will never be a good idea, paying for Visa or MasterCard gift card liquidation. Paying, I guess, more than you have to at the lowest possible rate, even would be a better way of saying it. You know, I'm willing to pay 1.5%, 2%. Between purchase fees and liquidations, given the right circumstance, but I'm not afraid of that. And I think that there is the idea out there that, well, the points should be free, so there should be nothing attached to them fee-wise. Two things that I don't like with that line of thinking. One, that means that you are going to take only the very, very best deals, like the $10 back in Safeway just for you on a Visa gift card purchase type deal. You are limited in those deals. There is very little scale in those deals. And you are foregoing offers that maybe are just as good or maybe are almost as good, but have a little bit more cost to them. And the second side of that I want to mention is that even with no fee, even with low cost liquidation, you are using an incredible amount of time. One of the biggest changes in my life this year is a new baby. And it's meant going to Walmart, standing in line for even 10 minutes is not happening. It's just not happening. You could not put a value on that for me right now. Someone could tell me it will save you $20 in liquidation fees. And I would say, yeah, it's not going to happen. So it's not going to save me $20 in liquidation fees. So I think that it's really dangerous to think, well, liquidation should be free or nearly free. And that's it. This goes way back, Robert, to the days of just wanting to do Bluebird loads. And that's it, because there was no cost, right? What's your take on it?
I think it goes to a post I wrote a while ago, calculating the net present value of a deal. The thing that you get into if you only do the absolute cheapest way to liquidate a gift card is a problem of scale. So I talked in that post about the NPV of a deal being a function of the spread, meaning how much of a profit are you getting after expenses, the scale, how much can you do it? You're talking about the you know, just for you deal or something like that. It's great for one thing, but it's hard to scale it. And then the time, like you were just saying, how much time does it take you to execute that? How many times do you go to Walmart and there's nothing happening there because there's a line or there's not the right situation there? And then I also talked about the probability of malfunction. You know, every step in this, every deal we have here has some probability of malfunction. So you put all this together and that determines what a good deal is. And if you aren't willing to pay a little bit of money to liquidate MasterCard gift cards and Visa gift cards, I think it really is limiting the upside that you can get in this game. So I agree. I love online liquidation, and it is something that really has changed how many points and miles I can earn.
Yeah. I think listeners that have maybe foregone those liquidation methods that cost 1.5 or even 2%, really, you got to do the math, and you could lose a ton of money if you're using the wrong cards. You really want to put your leverage to work here on 5x or 4x or 3x with uplift, and work that against your purchase fee and your liquidation cost. And you'll be surprised. Look, even if you're spending 65 or 70% of what you make on that, if you have uplift, you could be doubling your money. We'll have to get more into that on a paid show or something like that, Robert. Or maybe in a blog post, but it's really a topic that I don't see enough online, and it could just be revolutionary to those people listening.
Well, I think the sum of everything that we've talked about here is it's all about laying out a little bit of cash, right? It's not travelers free. It's laying out cash strategically to get what you want out of travel. You know, would you rather have just what you can do for free, or would you like to have, you know, 70% discount on exactly the kind of travel that you want to take? I'd like to have the 70% off any vacation I want to take. I think that is a better way to go for my situation. And if you happen to be currently cash strapped, I think that you can point some of your points and miles earning towards cash back earning to supplement a lot of these things. So again, you're not just limited to the things that points and miles can earn. There's always ways that you could instead earn cash back. So I hope that comes together to give a clear kind of viewpoint about how maybe we talk about things a little and think about things a little bit differently here on Milanomics than you might see on some other blogs or podcasts. So let us know if you have some questions about this, some thoughts about this. Let us know in the comments section, and we'll look forward to hearing from you.
I like it, Robert. You want to close this out?
Yes. Thanks for joining us this week. For a more in-depth discussion about points and miles, visit us at patreon.com/Milanomics. There you'll get a special link to listen to additional content right in your mobile podcast app or on your computer, where we speak more freely about topics like these.
And as always, you can reach us on Twitter. I'm at Milanomics, and Robert is at Robert Dwyer. We'd love to hear from you. Until then, we'll see you on the site.